From the McGrath Institute for Church Life and OSV Podcasts, this is Church Life Today. I'm Leonard DiLorenzo. Special thanks to our episode sponsor, NCEA. The National Catholic Educational Association 2023 convention is coming up soon. All Catholic school educators, administrators, and leaders are welcome to join us in Dallas, Irving, Texas, on April 11th to 13th, 2023. NCEA 2023 has it all, with professional development sessions, liturgies, and special events. Register using the link in the show notes, and we'll see you in Texas. After the overturn of Roe v. Wade, a wide array of commentators bemoaned how much more support would now be needed for women who become pregnant when abortion is no longer available, or at least less readily available. What that implies, of course, is that abortion is a substitute for other supportive measures for pregnant and parenting women, or even more to that point, that those other forms of support are substitutes for the perceived cure-all of abortion. My guest today calls out this implicit assumption in an essay she wrote that specifically focuses on the ways in which institutions of higher education do or do not adequately support women as women, with their distinctive reproductive capacities in view. Angela Franks is professor of theology at St. John's Seminary in Boston. She is no stranger to our own McGrath Institute for Church Life, as she currently serves as a Life and Human Dignity Writing Fellow for our Church Life Journal, and she has joined me on our show before to talk about gender, bodies, and the space of responsiveness. You can find the link to that episode in this episode's show notes. The article that is the basis of our discussion today, though, comes under the title, Why Does Higher Ed Throw Women Under the Bus?, which appeared in the Church Life Journal in September 2022, not long after the Supreme Court's landmark decision in the Dobbs case. Angela, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Angela, you wrote an essay responding to what you call, and I love this, a characteristically hysterical article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, where the author there claims that after Dobbs, it will be harder for colleges to retain women who are pregnant or have small children, whether they be students, faculty, staff. Now, complaints like this have become fairly typical since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. I want to start by asking you to help us see what is the underlying assumption in arguments like these?
I think there's two assumptions. I think the first assumption is that institutions are fixed and essentially unchangeable. The way we do things cannot change, but female fertility is malleable. It can change through technology. So I think that's the first assumption. The second assumption is that institutions do not have a responsibility toward women as women. And by that, I'm referencing what my friend Erica Bakiaki calls reproductive asymmetry. That women, by their very makeup as women, with our XX chromosomes and the works, like by our very makeup as women, we need different kinds of accommodations in the world because of our being ordered toward human generation, toward childbearing, toward child rearing, breastfeeding, all of that sort of thing. And that those things can't just go away. You know, we have technological approaches to reproduction that I'll talk more about today, I'm sure. But that technology doesn't make women not women. It doesn't make us not capable of pregnancy and childbearing. And so the second assumption I think that you hear from these institutions is that they don't really, first of all, I don't think they recognize that women are like that.
Yes.
They just aren't aware. And secondly, there's just no sense of any responsibility toward that. It's like, well, you know, our job as an institution is to provide abortion and contraception. Mm. And once after that's done, or maybe we can't do it anymore because of legal situations, but like we have no other responsibility toward women, toward helping them deal with this real reproductive asymmetry. Mm.
So thinking about this, Angela, from the perspective of institutions, or maybe not from their perspective, but thinking about institutions here, I wonder if you might comment on how then does granting access to abortion let institutions off easy?
Exactly. That's exactly what it does. And I think, no, it's dressed up under a lot of, you know, lovely sounding rhetoric about women's rights and caring about women's freedom and all of that. But when all is said and done, and this is also an observation Erica Bakiaki makes, when all is said and done, this is just simply abortion is a way to get out easy. It's a way to get off cheaply. Because it's much cheaper to just, you know, push a woman toward birth control and abortion than to pay for pregnancy and childbirth and to really try to accommodate women's lives. Mm. So there is certainly a cynical element to all of this.
Mm. And it takes a certain kind of, I suppose, skepticism on our part to be able to see that, like not just take this at face value, but think, what is the perceived benefit to an institution in really wanting to grant this kind of access? Well, part of the benefit is it just leaves more work off the table for the institution to really, as you were saying, support women as women. Now, right. You also make the claim that when abortion becomes women's health, and these quickly become somewhat synonymous, and when abortion becomes a choice, it also becomes de facto the only choice. Now, help us to understand that.
Yeah, this is actually something that surveys of post-abortive women show repeatedly, that women who go in for abortions report feeling like they had no other choice. So that's already very interesting, mm-hmm. that this is, you know, pre-Dobbs, just in general, women choosing abortion actually do not feel like it's a choice. They feel like it's their only option. Well, one of the factors in that response is how the institutions around them and maybe for whom they work, how those institutions respond to something like abortion. So it's a lot easier for an institution to say, well, you know, we'll fund your abortions, we'll fund your contraception, but we're not really going to contemplate changing around your workday, for example, or thinking about how to accommodate a student mother on campus or something like that. And so when institutions can say that they're offering a choice, but really the only choice that they're offering is abortion. Mm-hmm. Now, it's really the language of choice is very, again, kind of being deployed fairly cynically, because it's not actually a choice that's being offered. It's not the case that institutions are saying, well, on the one hand, here's the abortion and contraception. And on the other hand, here's what we're going to do for you if you do become a mother, and here's how we're going to accommodate you. That's not actually on the table. And so really the only thing being put forward is the technology, the abortion.
Now, to just touch on this article that you were responding to one more time, this wasn't just like one article that happened to be out there. I mean, it was representative of a number of different types of articles. It's just one that happened to speak about institutions of higher education. Nevertheless, though you clearly disagree with the underlying assumptions that the author is bringing to this article, you actually quite agree with the author. Not about that primary assumption, but about her recognition for the need for more support of women. She's saying in her article, well, now that access to abortion has been taken away in some states or restricted in others, now institutions are going to have to do a lot more to support women, and this is onerous and burdensome. And your response is to ask the question, well, why haven't institutions been doing more already? So take us through that a little bit, because that really gets us into what you're contributing to this conversation.
Yeah, she pointed out exactly what is the case, that most colleges do not accommodate pregnant students very well, that there are not spaces for breastfeeding, you know, there are not easily available spaces for childcare while a professor or a student is in class and all of that sort of thing. And so instead of focusing on what a burden it would be to provide these things, which was the article's perspective, we could flip that and say, okay, but why aren't these things being provided already? You know, it's been now, what, a good 100 years plus where women have been more or less pretty fully integrated into the universities in the sense that higher education has been made available to women.
Yeah.
But from the get-go, the assumption was always that women will behave like men. You know, we'll open up these spaces to you as long as there's no pregnancies, there's no children, there's no breastfeeding. In other words, as long as you look like men, which these spaces were designed to accommodate for literally centuries up until then. And so, you know, it's certainly good that these spaces were opened up to women, but we have to recognize that the bargain cannot be, reasonably speaking, we will let women into these spaces as long as they promise reproductively to act simply like men. Mm. That's not just, but it's also not possible. And that's part of the disconnect in the way institutions think, or more accurately, don't think about this sort of thing, that it's like they don't even realize that it's not working and that it can't possibly work because technologies will always fail. Women will always get pregnant who don't want to get pregnant, or even women will marry and get pregnant because they want to get pregnant. Fancy that. And so it's like there will always be situations in which you have women at these highly fertile times of their life, especially, who are getting pregnant and bearing children. And so to just pretend that we had the technological fix that solved the problem 100% and now surprisingly it was taken away and now we have a problem is a completely inaccurate way to view the situation.
Mm. This is Leonard DiLorenzo. You're listening to Church Life Today. I'm talking with Angela Franks, professor of theology at St. John's Seminary in Boston, and a Life and Human Dignity writing fellow for our Church Life Journal. We're talking about her essay titled, Why Does Higher Ed Throw Women Under the Bus?, which responds to post-Roe complaints from abortion proponents by arguing for a more holistically supportive environment in higher ed for women, especially when pregnant or parenting. Now, what you were just discussing there, Angela, is, it seems, something like this argument that on the surface seems to be very pro-woman, but is actually held captive to a male-centered thinking. So as you tease this out a little bit in the article, I'm just going to get it started here, and then I'd love for you to help us understand this better. So you say that what is operative is this assumption that the default human being is the fallen, unencumbered male who can walk away from the products of his sexual activity. In other words, you could reproduce, but that reproduction's outside and you have no responsibility for that. Now, that's the fallen, unencumbered male image, but that's the default image. So help us to understand this better and why this line of thinking is so powerful and pervasive.
Right. That's in many ways the deepest and best challenge of feminism when feminism is like being what it can be. So you see the early first wave feminists in the late 18th and the 19th centuries really struggling with that question. In fact, like how do we deal with a society in which the laws and expectations are structured around fallen male desires and abilities, where the man can be unfaithful to his wife, maybe generate children, whatever, but really can walk away from that situation as though it doesn't affect him, whereas the woman can never walk away. She can abort her child. She can do all kinds of things that are equally reprehensible, but she can't walk away. She has to deal with it. And that's part of this reproductive asymmetry. So the best thinkers within the women's rights movement have recognized that this is really our problem. The 20th century pivot that you start seeing with somebody like Margaret Sanger about 100 years ago is to say that no, vice is not our problem. Social structures are not our problem. The problem is female fertility. And that's the pivot that all of our institutions have now internalized. It's like, how are you going to help women? You're going to help them, quote unquote, control their fertility, which was Sanger's insight, that a false insight, but that was her grand plan, that we will only have liberated women if we recognize that female fertility is the problem and therefore technological control of that is the solution. And that is a perspective that's really alien to earlier women's rights thinkers and to the best women's rights thinkers who recognize that you don't liberate women by trying to liberate them from their body. Hmm. Like that just internalizes self-hatred, which we have in spades. In fact, like we can talk about all kinds of mm-hmm. examples of female hatred of their bodies. We liberate women by addressing vice and by addressing social structures that make vice easy, that perpetuate vice, and that prevent women from developing themselves as rational and as, as images of God, basically. And so that's really the major divide, even though it's hard to even recognize the earlier way of thinking because it's so foreign to us. We're so used to saying that women's problems are their fertile bodies that it's hard for us to even recognize that, in fact, vice and social structures are the real problems.
Mm. So you already, I think, introduced at the beginning of our conversation something of the alternative question to all of this. It's a basic, direct, but potentially revolutionary question. It's the question of what do women need precisely as women, right? So if you break from this male-centered thinking and make the default human being the sort of fallen male and instead actually ask a question that's more direct, what do women need as women? As you might also ask the question, what do men need as men? It opens up different considerations. So I was wondering if you could now take us down that avenue, because this is really where you take your own thinking and offer some recommendations. What sort of considerations come into view when you ask the question about the needs of women as women, perhaps precisely in higher education, though elsewhere as well?
Yeah, that's really well put. The first thing is to recognize this reproductive asymmetry mm-hmm. as something intrinsic to, in fact, what makes women women, like what makes us distinctive as a sex, which this ability to nurture a child within our bodies and then by the means of our bodies after the child's birth. And so you want to create institutions that, out of justice, recognize that this is how women are different, but also out of a kind of utilitarian advancement, really, that this is how they can retain women, in, for example, in the working world or attract them to their institutions of higher ed or whatever. It's a really, I think it's an actually very effective way of retaining women, you know, as valued employees. So how do we do that? So I think, first of all, it's very, very helpful to recognize the average lifespan, the reproductive lifespan of a woman, which is that she becomes fertile, you know, beginning in puberty, and hits peak fertility in her 20s. And then depending on all sorts of different factors, that fertility declines either somewhat gently or maybe rather steeply after her late 20s. And so that by the time you get to her late 30s and certainly her early 40s, a woman is by now much less fertile, maybe not fertile at all, in fact, depending again on the individual. And so when you're accommodating that, you want to keep in mind that when there are times in a woman's life where it is not easy for her to bear children, you do not want to create structures that encourage sexual activity. So I'm thinking particularly now of the undergraduate years. Mm. You know, the vast, vast majority of women are not married in between 18 and 22 while they're in an undergraduate institution. And you could argue probably shouldn't be, though. I'll leave that up to individuals to decide. But certainly your average sexual relationship among undergraduates, those relationships tend not to be especially healthy. They tend not to be ordered toward lifelong committed marriage and the rearing of children. And so we should not, as institutions, be encouraging sexual relationships in the undergraduate years as a matter of justice to women. In other words, I think things like college sex weeks and so forth are actually very misogynistic, not from intention, but by their effect. Because for one, these tend to promote the exact kind of sexual relationship that women say consistently in surveys they actually do not want. Mm. Even the most promiscuous women in their 20s say that they still value relationship as part of their sexual life. And so we're encouraging these uncommitted, unemotionally connected sexual relationships that women say that they do not want and that tend to make them depressed and more likely to cry every day and take antidepressants. And, you know, there's all sorts of statistics out there about that. So we're encouraging sexual relationships that are bad for women. I would argue bad for men as well, though it does not manifest itself quite as obviously in the early 20s. And then further, you're creating an environment which women are more likely to conceive a child when they are not really, when this pregnancy will be a crisis pregnancy, when mm-hmm. it's not the kind of pregnancy that they want, that they're looking for. And so I think it's a matter of justice towards women to be thoughtfully and intelligently encouraging of healthy relationships and discouraging of unemotional hookup kind of relationships. And so there's a ton of good sociology out there now about what constitutes good, loving relationships. What does it mean for a woman to be in a healthy relationship with a man? And what kinds of characteristics do you develop to be a good parent? Like there's so much that could be done on our college campuses in place of sex week that could be like loving relationship week, you know, that would actually benefit people, but especially I would argue benefit women.
Mm. This is Leonard DiLorenzo. You're listening to Church Life Today. My guest is Angela Franks, professor of theology at St. John's Seminary in Boston and a Life and Human Dignity writing fellow for our Church Life Journal. Now, there's a couple of things, at least, that I want to pick up on that you were just sharing. One is this issue of peak fertility years. So let's get back to that in a moment. I think maybe some of our listeners are maybe distracted by this idea of sex week that they haven't heard about before. And in fact, I don't think I had heard about it until I read your article. I was like, well, that can't be a very common thing. And I clicked on the hyperlink that went to advertisements about sex week. And sure enough, there are sex weeks at Tulane University and Vanderbilt and Ohio State and Hood College and just about everywhere else. We don't have it here at Notre Dame, thanks be to God. But the point you're making there, and maybe we can just stay here for one more moment, is this paradox between the promotion of promiscuous sex, which seems like it's for the sake of a very open, empowering, liberal, progressive kind of culture that gives power to women. And on the other hand, as you're pointing out, it's putting women in precisely the type of predicament where pregnancy is obviously more likely, where they're least likely to be able to bear a pregnancy, where the kind of relationships that come in something like sex week or the promotion of these promiscuous cultures lead to the sort of situations and feelings that women actually don't want. Actually, nobody really wants, men included. Can you just take us for just another moment or so in this incredible paradox, this irony, this sort of almost satire that's taking place here between the promotion of promiscuous sex on certain college campuses and, on the other hand, the lack of support for women as women?
Right. It could only happen against the backdrop of abortion and contraception and against the backdrop of believing that somehow abortion and contraception are 100% effective and really 100% consequence free, right? That there's no consequence in having abortion. There's no consequence in taking the birth control pill, and the pill works 100% anyway, like whatever kinds of, which is not the case. Let me be clear, that's not the case. Those kinds of attitudes are just not in touch with reality. And it's highly ironic as well, because these are institutions of higher education. We supposedly follow the capital S science, you know, like we supposedly care about this kind of thing. And yet it's this exceptional naivete that you can engage in this kind of activity. I believe it hurts men. It primarily hurts men emotionally and spiritually. It hurts women absolutely across the board. It hurts them emotionally and spiritually, but it also hurts them because, first of all, they have to either put themselves on hormones that maybe they don't like, and there's a whole feminist upsurge against hormonal contraception for very good reason. It maybe means that they're the ones who have to take themselves to the abortion clinic and suffer from that, the lifelong consequences of that. Like, it's just absolutely the worst thing we could be asking young women to do. And it is normalized by our institutions as part of, as you said, of being healthy and free and empowered and all of this. And to say all of that, you're asking women to go against their best instincts, which again, those manifest themselves very clearly in the surveys of women, where they want relationship, they want marriage, they want commitment, they want family, they want all of these things. And we're putting them in situations that basically tell them that to want those things is not empowering. And to be empowered is to act like a fallen male, where you have sex and you walk away and you have more sex. And that's just, it's a lie on every count.
Now, the second thing I wanted to bring us to, there's so much we could talk about more there, but maybe that's enough airtime for sex week for now. So the other thing that I wanted to follow up on is what you were pointing out in terms of peak fertility years, especially for women from mid to late 20s into the 30s. Now, for those who are thinking about women, men who are going off to college, getting into their career, those are also, they have become peak career building years, right? Like, this is where you really set the foundation for who you're going to be as professional. This includes in higher education for those who get into academia. These are the years for, you know, building up a publishing profile, establishing your reputation as a scholar, being at all the conferences, all of this stuff. Now, peak fertility and peak career foundation or advancement are coinciding in these years. So what gives there? That's part of what you're trying to get us to think about. Like, something's got to give, right?
Something does have to give. There's an economist who says women can have it all, but they probably cannot have it all at once. You know, just because human beings can't have everything at once, like we're limited. And so, I've been really blessed to, you know, I have six kids. I've been a full-time professor now for 14 years or something. But so in a lot of ways on paper, it looks like I had it all, but in fact, I made a huge number of mostly professional concessions, you know, where I just didn't publish for a long stretch of time. And so, you know, this is not a problem that, that men have to deal with. Now, it's not like I want fathers to be involved in raising their kids. And so I think that more and more men are going to start to raise these kinds of issues and have already started to raise them. But just as far as your fertility, as far as fertility goes, men do not face the same kind of asymmetry, and women do. And so we have to recognize that is there. I think in general, the more flexible job arrangements that have started to become a little bit more the norm in the pandemic, I think that those definitely benefit parents. And parents, especially women, but parents of both sexes, indicate a preference for those kinds of more flexible arrangements so that they don't have to feel like there's just nothing here in my, there's no give in my schedule. Like, nothing can go wrong. Nobody can get sick, you know, like nobody needs a doctor's appointment. Like, nothing can happen to go wrong because, like, there's just no fat here in my schedule. And so, like, I think parents need that kind of flexibility. Again, if employers want to retain quality people, including especially women. In academia in particular, I feel like given that we have a whole system of Catholic institutions of higher ed, I feel like there's a lot of promise there. I don't honestly see a lot of willingness to follow this path, but hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully there's like a real interest in doing something different. The most important thing that I see in higher ed is normalizing for women something like part-time academic work, something like adjuncting for 10, 15 years, teaching one or two classes, you know, whatever that looks like, but normalizing that, because the way it is now, if you go in that track, it looks like the message is sent that this is a person who's not tenure track job capable, right? So the only reason they're there must be because they're the quality of their intellectual gifts is low. Or lower, obviously, if you're a professor, you have intellectual gifts. But there's this stigma against doing that kind of part-time work. And I think for women in particular, we really need to destigmatize that possibility, because women, it's very hard in my experience, from what I've seen of friends and so forth, to, you know, say, get your doctorate at age 28 or 30, start having kids, be out of academia for 10 or 12 years, and then come back. Like, I don't know anybody who's done that.
Right.
Maybe people have. I think that's very, very, very rare. And so what women who are interested in continuing in academia need to be able to do that adjunct online teaching, whatever it is, where they keep their toe in it.
Yeah.
Maybe they write an article every 5 years or something, but where they're really just kind of keeping things fresh so that then they're able, when their kids grow up, then they're able to really return and give it their attention.
I mean, it seems very much like what you're pointing towards is the need for this diversity of paths, that perhaps one of the consequences of whether it's the male-centered thinking or just institutions and higher education and otherwise becoming recalcitrant in their thinking is you come up with one kind of standard path, and then really diverse human beings have to adjust to that path. And the greatest diversity that we're talking about here is the diversity between men and women, which are, they're non-identical, right? So how does that sound? I mean, is that basically the kind of creativity we have to inculcate in our institutions towards this kind of diversity of paths for what it means to study and work and grow as a professional and have an actual life as well?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's the again, we're dealing with institutions that for centuries just centered around males, often celibate males even.
Right.
And so it's that that's a very narrow certain kind of way of proceeding, but it's not going to fit women, for example, especially married women. I think, you know, I venture to say there's an awful lot of men for whom that one particular path doesn't fit very well either.
Right.
And so I think that the more that we can be open to different ways that people can pursue these kinds of professional development. I think that that's just benefits everyone. And again, I think ultimately it benefits the institution, even though I don't want to be naive about the kind of growing pains that would be involved in making that shift.
Indeed. Friends, we've been talking with Angela Franks. We've been following up mostly on her article that was published in the Church Life Journal under the title, Why Does Higher Ed Throw Women Under the Bus? You can find that article at the Church Life Journal, along with a number of other articles by Angela Franks. I promise you, you will never be disappointed by something that you read of hers. Angela, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Leo. Thanks so much.
And thanks to all of you for being with us on Church Life today.
This has been a production of OSV Podcasts. To learn more, visit osvpodcasts.com.